This podcast is for alcoholics that have a willingness to recover from their alcoholism by being taught and practicing the principles of the 12 steps as outlined in the Big Book and the 12 and 12 of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Ilya, and I am an alcoholic. Page XIII, forward to first edition, first paragraph. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person, and besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. Page 72 of the Big Book, Chapter 6, Into Action. First full paragraph. Having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. We have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which, when completed, will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. So now Bill is telling us what the action is now that we've done the inventory. And he uses the word defects instead of wrongs. So if you turn to page 55 of the 12 and 12, you'll see that the at the top of the essay, it says, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Well, Bill says in this paragraph, this requires action on our part, which when completed, it will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. So remember when I said that Bill didn't like to use the same word twice, this is evidence of that right now. Wrongs doesn't mean how you've necessarily harmed another person or that you were wrong in an argument and now you need to apologize that you were wrong and you check the facts and you're admitting that you were wrong in that discussion. No, it's not what it means. Defects is wrongs, flaws, character defects and shortcomings. Or mistakes, and they all equal the five things that we talked about before: selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, fear, and inconsideration of others. So whenever you see those words, you can automatically know it's one of those five major character defects. Makes it a lot easier to understand what we're trying to cast out. He says these are things about to be cast out. So there's nothing we can do about the first three columns. We have the information on how the defect was activated, but we do, you know, have no control. We have no control over who, what, where, and when the principal, the person, or the institution had. We have a resentment toward, or the fear that we have. These are all line items that we have no control over. And then you have the cause and the instinct. I don't even have any control over the instinct. All I know is that I can trace it back to a threatened base instinct. But the fourth column is the only thing I can do anything about. And those are the defects of character, which are those five things. And now that I know that a defect, a wrong, and a mistake, and a shortcoming all mean those five things, I can clearly see that in order for me to unblock myself and be rid of the things that are in my way, to God's will and to a connection with my higher power, a new relationship with our Creator, as Bill puts it. The obstacles in my path are these defects of character, and now I need to get rid of them. So that is the mission that we're on here. When we're knee deep in the work, that's what we're trying to accomplish. So it may seem like a daunting task, but Bill addresses that in the next paragraph. Page 72, second full paragraph. This is perhaps difficult, especially discussing our defects with another person. We think we have done well enough at admitting these defects to ourselves. There is doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Many of us thought it necessary to go much further. We will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reasons why we should do so. So that is clearly the first fear that all alcoholics have is now I need to admit this to another person. I've done this myself. It was hard enough. That should be sufficient, but it's saying that it is insufficient, even though we try to convince ourselves that it is because we're in fear of discussing this with another person because we don't want them to know our deep, dark secrets. The outcome of that admission is scary, to be quite honest. It was for me. So I didn't certainly want to admit my inventory to anybody. When I completed it, I felt good enough, and truthfully, I didn't even do it correctly the first time. The first time I wrote an essay that was like the size of a book, and then I read that to my sponsor, and he said, "Congratulations, you just did the second half of the first step." I said, "What are you talking about? I just did an inventory. I told you everything and admitted everything and every dark secret that I confessed to you, like, going to church and confession." And he said, "That's not what we're doing. Confession is a part of the inventory process, but you didn't do an inventory. You just did the second half of the first step." I go, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, you admitted how much your life is unmanageable in detail." I thought about it and I said, "That's pretty much correct. This is the story I've told myself and the unmanageability of it and why I deserve to have my resentments, fears, and why I harmed everybody around me." It was more like a manifesto, if anything, or a rant or a screed. So I said, "Wow, that's not an inventory." He said, "Well, most people just get that far. They're in the delusion that they're working the program and they're not because they've come up with their own ideas about what this program is because they haven't even read the book. And if they have, they just decided that they're not going to do it the way that the book says and how it works." So there we are. And if most people go, in just writing an essay and then they get the courage to read it to a sponsor. But even if you've done the work correctly and written out the worksheets or filled in the worksheets, then you still have to admit it to another human being nonetheless. So let's read on. We're still on the second paragraph. We will be more reconciled discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reasons why we should do so. The best reason first. If we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. We think the reason is that they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought that they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought that they had humbled themselves, but they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary until they told someone else all their life story. So there's many. The first important, most important reason that we need to do this is because we most likely will go out and get drunk again. So remember, we said that we go to any lengths to get sober, and not admitting this inventory to another human being is the very first reason why we're, let's face it, we're all here in the first place. Nobody would have gotten this far in the program to the fifth, to done a fourth step if you're still listening. I probably lost a lot of listeners after one, two, and three, which is fine. They just didn't make a decision, or they didn't agree that with the problem or the solution, one of the three, and they haven't even bothered continuing to listen. But, you know, I can't help everybody. All I can do is carry this message. So, based on what the book says and my experience, yes, I've done partial inventories before. I've done, I've left things out, and my restlessness, irritability, and discontent emotions resurrected, and I wanted to drink because I haven't brought the subconscious out to the conscious. So putting it on paper sheds light on it, and then I need to share that light with another human being. And those are two things that are very difficult to ask of an alcoholic, but it's necessary, or I'll drink. So let's say I skip the step five and I persevere with the rest of the program and wonder why it didn't work. You know, it says, wonder why I fell. Well, because I didn't do the whole AA program. You know, if we turn back to step three, it says at the bottom of the page on the 12 and 12, when I say step three, I mean 12 and 12. It says, in fact, the effectiveness of the whole AA program will rest upon how well and earnestly we have tried to come to a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. So I haven't really made an earnest decision if I'm willing to skip step five and just discuss my inventory with myself. My sponsor used to say, a broken mind can't fix your broken mind can't fix your mind. So my mind at this point is still broken and I'm still insane. So if you turn to page 56, there's a sentence in here of the 12 and 12 that talks about people who don't do this critical step. And then they go on for years becoming more and more miserable. And the more miserable they are, the more, you know, misery loves company. They don't want to see people do the program because they know that they haven't. So, you know, be careful again of a sponsor who hasn't done a fifth step in his lifetime and is still sticking around the rooms for relief, even though that they're not happy, joyous, and free. But let's read 56, if you don't believe me. In the middle of the first full paragraph, it says, even AA old-timers, sober for years, often pay dearly for skimping this step. They will tell how they tried to carry the load alone, how much they suffered of irritability, anxiety, remorse, and depression, and how unconsciously seeking relief, they would sometimes accuse their best friends of the very character defects they themselves were trying to conceal. They always discovered that relief never came by confessing the sins of other people. Everybody had to confess his own. If you don't know, once Bill called those types of people losers that came to meetings and that don't drink. There are many of them. And they will come to AA. They've never admitted their defects of character to another human being. Who knows if they've even done a real fourth step. And they sit around accusing everybody else of the very defects they conceal themselves to feel better. But it doesn't work. They never get relief. by pointing the finger at another person. And they go to meetings to try to feel better, and it doesn't work anymore. Just like alcohol stopped working years ago, so does this method of blaming others. And you may find people who know this program and speak it well, but still haven't done a fourth and fifth step. And yet, you know, they understand that it needs to be done, so they sit around, you know, accusing others that they're not doing the program that they never did. So, I better teach this program to you is my way out of not having to do it. And it doesn't work. And I'll admit that I've had, you know, many times where I've experienced that. I thought that I could wiggle my way out of this program by simply teaching it. And sometimes I try that to relieve myself of my, you know, my restlessness. And it's skipping steps, to be honest. I need to do another fourth and fifth step sometimes in my life. When we get to step 10, you'll see that this is an ongoing life process. But in the beginning, it's a house cleaning. So if you're new, you know, you need to do a house cleaning before you can continue cleaning the house. There's a lot of wreckage there that you can't just dust over. Later on, you can keep it clean when you make it to 10. But right now, the place is trashed. And I say place, I mean your inner life is trashed. And that includes, you know, the harms you've done to others. But right now we're just focusing on what it is that's in you that's defective. So if you never complete your house cleaning, or just take inventory and hang on to the worst items, like, you know, let's say you're, you know, lustful, it's impossible to not be selfish and dishonest if you're lustful. So lust is an outcome of a sex instinct, an out of whack sex instinct. And what accompanies that, whether you like it or not, is selfishness and dishonesty and possibly fear and inconsideration. It depends. That's just one example. So, you know, you think that you've become humble. You think that you've lost your egoism and fear. But in fact, when you think something that isn't true, you're being dishonest and you don't even know it. So self-centered dishonesty is a huge component of this disease. Dishonesty doesn't just mean cash register dishonest, where I'm not going to steal from the till anymore, so now I'm an honest man. No, honesty includes looking at yourself and not knowing that you've been dishonest when you have been, and you're mainly dishonest with yourself. So the program requires us to reveal those defects that we're not even aware of. And that's why we have to do this inventory with another human being, because we're not even aware of these defects of character by doing an inventory by ourselves. So enough humility needs to be within us in order for us to get to God's will. So if we look at page 58, it says, you know, he's talking about humility now in the 12 and 12. On 73, he says, but they had not learned enough of humility. So now Bill Wilson's introducing humility to us, because in 7, we humbly ask God to remove our defects. Well, this is how we get humble. We can't ask God to remove something humbly if we don't even know what humility is. And humility is not the same as the definition of humility in the dictionary in AA. It's a total different definition. It's in the literature. It's specifically on page 58 of the 12 and 12 in step 5, where no mention of the word humility is mentioned off the wall in the step, but it is mentioned. It is the beginning of humility when it relates to this program. So Bill Wilson puts it in step 5 and defines it very clearly. So if you turn to page 58 of the 12 and 12, It says in the first full paragraph, another great dividend we may expect from confiding our defects to another human being is humility, a word often misunderstood. To those of us who have made progress in AA, it amounts to a clear recognition of what and who we really are, followed by a sincere attempt to become what we could be. Therefore, our first practical move toward humility must consist of recognizing our deficiencies. So, the definition of AA humility is right there, right buried in the middle of page 58 on the 12, in the 12 and 12. You may have gone to several meetings where everyone has the topic maybe humility, and no one has even read that or knows where this is. It's pretty clear to me that it's right there. There's no hidden meaning about it. He says straight up a word often misunderstood, and this is what it is. So the first part is it amounts to a clear recognition of what and who we really are. So that's part one. Step four and five help me do that. Step four and five is the first part of that humility definition. So what and who am I really? Am I an a-hole? Yes. Okay. Well, that's good. I need to know that before I can not be one. So it's okay that I'm a jerk. It's okay that I have these defects of character. I'm not here to beat myself up because I have them. I'm here to uncover and discover them so I can understand their exact nature. And that is all my higher power is asking of me. That's all my higher power is asking me to do at this point, is just to do the work so I can understand what my deficiencies are. And the first practical move towards that, towards humility, must consist of recognizing our deficiencies. Again, another word for defects, wrongs, mistakes, shortcomings, character flaws. Those are all those five things. And I'm going to say what they are again. What are deficiencies? Selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate of others. So write those down because it will always be one or a combination of those deficiencies that cause you trouble and get you in trouble. And without knowing where they came from, which is my base instinct being threatened, I cannot understand what they are. You can call me selfish all you want, but if I don't understand why I'm selfish as it relates to an instinct that's out of whack, then it makes no sense to me, and I think that I can't change. But now that I understand, I know where it comes from, and then I can be willing later on, which is the second half of the program of the of excuse me, of the word humility, which says followed by a sincere attempt to become what we could be. So that's the second half of humility. Once I've done four and five, what I could be is somebody who doesn't have these defects, or we'll get into, that they're never completely ever gone, like instincts, but they can be taken away enough to where I'm not extremely selfish, extremely dishonest, extremely inconsiderate, extremely self-seeking, extremely fearful. Remember, this is a disease of extremes. So there's a difference between removing selfishness entirely and being extremely selfish. There is no removal of it entirely, which we'll get into in the next six and seven. But I didn't want you to move forward thinking it's impossible to remove selfishness entirely. Well, A, you can't remove any of it. You don't have the power, just like you're drinking. And B, you'll never remove all of your selfishness as long as you have a body and a mind, just like you'll never remove your instincts. But by will being willing to remove the instinct, the I'm sorry, by willing to remove your deficiencies, that's all your higher power needs from you. And it will remove them to its liking, not yours, and then your instincts will be balanced in return. So if you're wondering how the hell am I going to balance my instincts as a result of removing my character defects, you're not. You're not removing your defects, your higher power is, and your higher power is also balancing and tempering your God-given instincts. All you have to do is play your part. You have to do the work, and you'll see that peace and serenity will come as a result of that. But you, if you're new, you're not there yet. You just have to trust that what this book is saying is going to work. But we call these promises for a reason, because promises mean that they work. This is what you will receive in return if you do this work. And the book is very clear on what that what you get in return. You don't get more power, money, and sex in return by being a good AAer and following the rules. There's no guarantees that you're going to be a rich, wealthy person and get married because you've done this work. Okay, everybody has their own path in life, and that may not be your path. But either whatever your path is, your higher power will help you and give you peace along the way, and you'll be happy no matter what the conditions are. So that is, why we do this, just to remind you. It's not about humiliating you. Humiliating and humiliation and humility are two different words, even though they sound similar. They are not the same words. So now that you know that, if you don't tell another human being the exact nature of your wrongs, your defects, and go through these inventories, you're not getting the relief that comes with a confession, which is a part of this, because you have to tell your life story. But B, the main purpose of this exercise is to recognize your deficiencies, and you can't do that alone. You don't have the information. You need a second opinion from another alcoholic, or someone who understands what you're trying to accomplish. So then he goes into page 73, third paragraph. More than most people, I'm sorry, page 73, first full paragraph on the big in the big book. More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. Now, that was certainly my experience. I had two masks that I wore, one that the world will see, and the one that, my family will see, and one that my friends will see, one that my employer will see, actually, multiple masks. And I enjoyed a certain reputation from all of those, but I knew that in deep down that I didn't deserve it because I was full of character defects that I didn't even know that were there or were even called those, let alone there. And my subconscious knew that it felt guilty. So he uses the actor example again. I'm an actor. I'm pretending to be something I'm not. And when we pretend to be something that we weren't created to be, right, we're being dishonest with our very lives, and that creates an emotional turmoil, and we end up very sick as a result of that. So let's read on. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he is revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As far as he can, he pushes these memories far inside himself. He hopes that we'll never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension that makes for more drinking. So now Bill's taking us back to when we drank and why we drank. We were trying to bury these emotions and this guilt and remorse and shame through alcohol. And we've done things while drinking and not drinking that are terrible and reprehensible to us. And these memories become a nightmare. And the best thing that we can do, think of to do, is to blot it out with alcohol, blot out reality. And when I come to my senses after a binge or a spree, I, make a proclamation never to drink again like that, and then the cycle continues after a week or two because I forget what it felt like. So I talked about other podcasts that, it's impossible to play the tape because we forget what it felt like. We may even recall the memory, but it's still insufficient. If you go back to the doctor's opinion, it talks about the if we drink for the effect, and we have the cycle of feeling remorseful and making a firm resolution to drink again, which is an honest resolution, but then we repeat the drinking phases over and over again. So again, this is another reason why we have to do this work, because these subconscious feelings need to be brought to the conscience. You have to shed light on it, and if you don't, it's just going to stay in the dark and it's going to overpower you. And that's why at certain times we can't, decide not to drink on intellectual information about our alcoholism alone. At certain times, we had to have a higher power. So next paragraph. Psychologists are inclined to agree with us. We have spent thousands of dollars for examinations. We know but few instances where we have given these doctors a fair break. We have seldom told them the whole truth, nor have we followed their advice. Unwilling to be honest with these sympathetic men, we were honest with no one else. Small wonder many in the medical profession have a low opinion of alcoholics and their chance of recovery. Explanation point. Bill doesn't put that many explanation points, so he's trying to hit home that I don't know about you, but I've spent lots of money on psychologists over the years, and I wasn't completely honest with them. And I consider myself a pretty honest guy. It's something that I've been given. For some reason, I've been honest. But even that alone didn't even work. So even if you're not going to tell the psychologist the truth, it doesn't necessarily mean that I meant to lie to psychologists. I didn't know that I wasn't being honest. So I thought I was being so forthright, so open, because I just wanted this psychologist to cure me of whatever it is that was eating me up inside. And I figured, be smart about it, go see a psychologist, and we'll get it figured out. And they couldn't fix me. Remember the ABCs, Dr. Young is B, and how it works. Dr. Young said, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Well, he didn't say that, but that's where Bill got it from. So a psychologist couldn't relieve my alcoholism. I mean, I may have gotten temporarily relief by being honest or having a session with them, but I could not have the alcoholic problem removed. And at that point, I didn't even know I was an alcoholic. I just knew that I self-medicated, and that's what they even called it. No one had dared to call me a straight-up alcoholic. I wish they had, but they didn't. So, maybe they just wanted me to keep coming back to them for more money. That's their profession too, but whatever. There are some that try to help, and yet they may think they have the power to help when they really don't. But we remember we had two psychologists and one prestigious doctor. One of those psychiatrist was the founding father of psychiatry itself, Dr. Carl Jung. And then the medical doctor was a chief physician, and they had the humility to say in writing that we couldn't help you people. So if you're seeing a psychologist that thinks he can help you and you're an alcoholic, then maybe you need to rethink that. I don't know, because they can't fix us, and they had a low opinion of alcoholics and a chance of their recovery. Well, that really doesn't help you very much there, does it? So they don't understand the disease, and I wouldn't be seeing a psychologist again if they didn't understand and accept that I have an alcoholic mind. That's been my experience, because there's nothing wrong with still seeing a psychologist. That's because I've uncovered stuff about myself that would complement my recovery, not in place of my recovery. And there's a difference. So we go back to the bottom of page 73. We must be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live long or happily in this world. Rightly and naturally, we think well before we choose the person or persons with whom which to take this intimate and confidential step. So I've said that in other podcasts, you have to be careful on who your sponsor is or who the individual is that you take this step with. It says that we have to be to think well before we choose the person. This is an intimate step. They have to know what we're trying to accomplish, and why. So, Bill gives us some ideas. Those of us belonging to a religious denomination, which requires confession, must, and of course, will want to go to the properly appointed authority whose duty it is to receive it. Those we have no that those though we have no religious connection, we may still do well to talk with someone ordained by an established religion. We often find such a person quick to see and understand our problem. Of course, we sometimes encounter people who do not understand alcoholics. So remember, this book was written in the 30s. They're doing the best they can with the resources they had available, and it was, they had a Christian upbringing, but even then, he's still being open-minded about those who have religious connections and those who don't. And back then, to be quite honest, people had pretty good character. So there was a lot of people to find, and help us remove these blocks. Now we have all kinds of confusing money organizations that are trying to use us for use our disease against us to collect. And you also have people in meetings who don't work this program. You have religious people who don't understand your disease, even though they're religious. So you need to be careful on who this individual is. But we often find such a person quick to see and understand our problem. That's not so much the case anymore. So he says, of course, we sometimes encounter people who do not understand alcoholics, and there's more of them out there now these days, even if they're in so-called recovery. So, they're the old-timers who work this program are dying off. So if you find one of those, I would grab onto them, like I did, because I'm explaining this program the way that it was taught to me right out of the book. And it was put in layman's terms, which I'm trying to do for you. So now we don't want to be take too long to find somebody either. So there is a paragraph about that very thing. Which I'll find in a moment. I'm actually having a hard time finding it right now, so I'll get back to that. But there, you'll have to trust me that there's a paragraph, which I'll get to at some point, that talks about being too prudent, and using that as an excuse of avoidance. So now, let's continue reading. So now we know we have to pick someone who understands what we're trying to accomplish, and now we're on page 74. Just to go back, actually, I had three sponsors. One was when I was new, really the right person that I needed at the time. But I moved on from them because I wasn't being taught the literature, because I found a guy who was teaching the literature in a classroom setting, and he is the one who taught me this program, among other a small group of us who attended his teaching of the program. So I would consider my second sponsor my big book sponsor, and he taught me the letter of the law of this program. And the third person I also had at the same time was somebody who was my YABBA sponsor. I could go to him for each irritation, each emotional crisis I was having, and he was wonderful in helping me through the really painful times in the beginning as well, within the first few years of my recovery. So I thank them all. They were all where they needed to be at the time I needed them. My higher power placed all three of them in my life at different times in my recovery. But if I wasn't ready, my higher power would not have put those people in my life at the right time that I needed them. But they all were interconnected in helping me where I was at the time. But I also knew when it was time to move on from one of them. One of them, the big book sponsor, passed away. So I was lucky enough to get this information from this man, after 30 years of sobriety, before he passed away. The first person I actually had to politely let go of because I wasn't being taught the program. I was being taught an alternative program, and I didn't discover that until my big book sponsor came along. And so I was like, I'm really gonna, work with this guy now and go to this class. And I called him when I had questions about the literature. So, and then in that class, I met another individual who I identified with and helped me tremendously, and I probably wouldn't have stayed sober without all three of their help at the given time that they were in my lives. So don't be too prudent. You're not interviewing for the perfect person. You're interviewing for who your higher power puts in your life, and you're like, wow, that's the guy. I know it. Now, am I going to look for excuse not to work with them, or am I going to go ahead and use, this opportunity that my higher power has given me to work with them? So that was just my experience. So next, we're on page 74. If we cannot or would rather not do this, we search our acquaintances for a close-mouthed, understanding friend. Perhaps our doctor or psychologist will be the person. It may be one of our own family, but we cannot disclose anything to our wives or our parents, which will hurt them and make them unhappy. We have no right to save our own skin at another person's expense. Such parts of our story we tell to someone who will understand yet be unaffected. The rule is we must be hard on ourselves but always considerate of others. For me, it was difficult to choose a family member because it was impossible to be considerate of their feelings, and I had attachments to them. They were intertwined in my alcoholism, and my disease had affected them. So it really made no sense at all to be a family member. Eventually, I would have to make amends to them, and the very act of getting sober is the beginning of my amends anyway. So why would I want to make them miserable, more miserable along the way, and bring up things that could make them unhappy, and harm what I'm trying to accomplish? We could eventually endanger me into drinking again anyway. So Bill's trying to suggest, give some recommendations. Someone who's not going to shoot their mouth off about you and gossip, someone who's understanding, but even a good friend may not be a good fit because they, I have attachments to that friend. I may not be as as forthright as I would be with a new person in my life. A doctor, a psychologist, fine, as long as they understand alcoholism and they understand the fourth and fifth step and what you're trying to accomplish, that's fine too. I found that another alcoholic who really understood and worked this program was the best fit because they understood my disease, they had my disease, and they succeeded in arresting their disease. So I want what they have and I want to know how they did it. So I'm going to work with, in my opinion, another alcoholic who's recovered. And those are harder to find. Make sure that when you're learning this program, once again, if they're not showing you the literature and they're just sitting there listening to your story, as a courtesy, you're really, not getting anything out of it. They're actually sitting there going, oh my God, what do I tell you? Because they don't know. You need to be careful. In any case, Bill's trying to reinforce that point. Next paragraph. Notwithstanding the great necessity for discussing ourselves with someone, it may be one is so situated that there is no suitable person available. If that is so, this step may be postponed. Only, however, if we hold ourselves in complete readiness to go through with it at the first opportunity. We say this because we are very anxious and that we talk to the right people, to the right person. Sorry, one person. It is impossible that he be able to keep a. It is impossible. It is, excuse me. It is important that he be able to keep a confidence that he fully understand and approve what we are driving at, that he will not try to change our plan. But we must not use this as a mere excuse to postpone. So that's kind of what I'm talking about here is, we need to find somebody who understands what we're trying to do here. It's important that we be able that they keep a confidence. We have to trust them, and they have to understand and approve of what we're driving at. And if they try to change our plan, what does that mean? Change our plan? Well, they start playing God. They start telling us how to live, who to date, where to work, how to behave. That's not what the point of a sponsor is. Their point is to help you uncover and discover your character deficiencies based on the evidence in your inventories. That's it. And maybe the story that you told yourself will be different than what they explain. And that's good, because they're giving you the truth instead of your version of the truth. So it is important to make sure that they understand why you're doing this. So he says in the second paragraph here, on the first full paragraph on 75, when we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time. We have a written inventory, and we are prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner what we are about to do and why we have to do it. He should realize that we are engaged upon a life and death errand. Most people approach in this way will be glad to help. They will be honored by our confidence. So every time I try to make a point, my opinion just gets backed up by Bill. I just know this stuff, you know, is so true because I've worked it, that, you know, I have had sponsors that I wouldn't give my inventory to, or people that I wouldn't trust. That doesn't mean I can't, you know, I have to go around being suspicious of everybody, but I have to have an innate, you know, intuition that this is the guy and I need to take this chance eventually. So once I decide who that person is, you know, I go for it. I don't sit around on my inventory, because sitting around after you've written an inventory like that can be very dangerous. You don't want to waste time, because then you can start getting sick again. Now you start to feel guilty and remorseful and more resentful and more fearful, because now it's all on paper. You don't know what to do with it. And it's like opening your chest and not doing surgery and just leaving it open. You need to start the process. You need to get in there. So we have a written inventory, which is what you can't sit on. And now you're prepared for a very, very long talk with your sponsor. You're going to go through your resentment inventory, your fear inventory, your sex relationship inventory, and your harm to others. Now, a long talk could be like 10 hours. I don't know. You may want to break it out into, you know, different sessions. For me, I had a long talk, you know, after 3 hours of resentment. I was exhausted. So I went through my resentment inventory. We slept on it. And then I went back the next day and then did the fear. And then after that, I did the sex. And then after that, I did the harms to others, you know, because there were a lot of them on there. And that leads to a lot of conversation about each line item. But I had to admit every single one of them. So, you know, I'm explaining to the partner, to the sponsor, to the other human being what I'm about to do and why they have to do it. Hopefully I've already done that. And then they understand, you know, this is the kicker right here. They understand that we are engaged on a life and death errand. This isn't a casual exercise just to be a better human being. You know, that'll come. But the point is that you have a literal universe has a gun to our head, if you think about it. I mean, why would we be doing this if it didn't? I wouldn't. I would never have done this in a million years if it wasn't a matter of life or death. So this is a life and death errand. It's an errand I'm running with this person, because if I don't do it, I'm going to die. And that's just the nature of the disease. It'll kill me. And I have to remind myself of that when I'm in the middle of these inventories and these decisions to proceed with the rest of the program. And the bottom line is that that's the ultimate result, if I don't do it, is death. So the individual that you're going to do this with is somebody that you can trust to the best of your ability. With the help of your higher power, you're going to pick them out. With the help of your higher power, there's an old expression, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear, and then you are able to move forward with this. You've got everything organized, nice and neat on your inventory sheets, and now you're going to read across for each resentment, each fear, each sex relationship, and each harm to other. And that can take a long, long time to get that all out. And you can't leave anything off, okay? So we're going to go into the promises that happen once you read this inventory. Okay, now there's a new set of promises. There's like 165 five, six promises in this whole book. But now we're going to read the fifth step promises. And these are one of the more popular ones. You may have heard these in meetings. So the fifth step promise reads on page 75, the second full paragraph. We pocket our pride and go for it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken this step, without withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. So he's saying that, you know, we may feel like the drink problem has been removed, but it hasn't. It just feels that way. We're not done with the rest of the program, so we could relapse if we don't continue, but it's a feeling that it has been removed, nothing more. But the fact that we've actually confided in another person and have read these rocks that have been on our back and weighing us down for years and years and years are dropped for them, you know, are revealed, I should say. We haven't dropped them yet, but we feel the experience that comes with it as if they're gone, you know, and that is an incredible feeling. It's a wonderful experience, and I would, you know, you don't want to deprive yourself of that, because if you don't have this experience, how can you expect to have conscious contact with your higher power in 11? You can't. When you don't, you know, do the fifth step, you're under the illusion that you're in God's will until you have some humility and understand who and what you really are. You can't become who you could be. So this fifth step is the first part of that, and one of the things that come with that is being able to look the world in the eye. It's like you have hope now. You don't have to hold your head down. We can be at perfect peace and ease. We start to feel peace and serenity. You know, the fears falling away. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. These are all things that we now we're unblocking ourselves. We're starting to remove, shed light on the chunks that are blocking us in the darkness. And our higher power is illuminating that light, if you will, for a while, so we can, you know, be encouraged that this process is really working. That's really what these fifth steps promises are, is encouragement that the process is working. But we're not done. So I've seen people go back out after the fifth step. That's why you know, don't want to put too much emphasis on these promises, because they're fifth step promises. There's still seven steps to go. Enjoy the fifth step promises and understand that all you did was illuminate the darkness. And now you're, you know, going to have to use that light, because that light will fade, you know, like a candle has a certain amount of wax, and that light will fade if you don't continue on. And remove forward with steps 6 through 12. But it's a wonderful experience. So Bill's giving us some advice on what to do after such a big event. He says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first five proposals, we ask if we had omitted anything, if we were building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? So he's reminding us how well of a job did we do? Were we thorough or not? Did we leave things out? Did we hide certain acts of evil that we've committed from our sponsor in our inventory, thinking that it's none of their business when it is? Because now we're, you know, only as sick of our secrets, if you've heard that expression. and you're still sick if you haven't done the entire confessional part of this. We have to read and say, all right, yeah, I didn't do that. I'm taking that to the grave. I haven't really made a decision to do all the 12 steps. So the book is, you know, he's asking, you know, using the construction analogy again, you're building an arch. And you're going to walk through that arch. And if the arch isn't sturdy and built on a good foundation and falls apart, you're not going to be able to walk to freedom. So it is a matter of life and death to do this the best to your ability. Now, no one's asking you to do it better than your ability, just to the best of your ability. And if you know you haven't in your innermost self, then you need to revisit the things you've left out, is what he's saying. So then that's pretty much the end of the fifth step in the big book. It takes us to step six next. But there are some things in step five in the 12 and 12 that I want to go over before we move on to step six, because I like to use the 12 and 12 to close some of the loopholes that every alcoholic thinks of on why they don't want to do this. But the directions are clear in the big book, and I've read them. But next comes the rationalization of an alcoholic to prevent ourselves from doing them. So I want to cover those in the next podcast so we can understand what it's going to take to pocket our pride and go for it. So I hope you all are having a great week so far and have more understanding on the importance of why we need a sponsor or another human being that we can trust to do this with. And at the very least, if your sponsor is not your big book sponsor, then I'm teaching you the big book. Just like I would if you were sitting here in front of me. So with that in mind, if your sponsor is not teaching you any of this literature or giving advice that isn't in here and saying, no, you were right. You have every right to have that resentment. Let's move on to the next one. You know, you're not worth the right person. All right. So these are signals that you can use now to know the difference between trusting somebody that knows the literature and trusting an egomaniac who doesn't. And that's what I'm trying to help you from. You know, remember, life or death. You want someone to lead you off a cliff. They can be very persuasive, but invariably you're dead and they're not. So that's why this is vital. So have a great week, and I look forward to the next podcast. God bless. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.